These sport coats, you guys all look like you're going to homecoming.
Okay, thank you, Claire.
It's cute.
Claire.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. I hope everyone enjoyed the break. We're going to dive right back into the two political stories of the fall, the impeachment inquiry in the House, and the somewhat fluid race for the Democratic presidential nomination. We're going to get an update on where public opinion stands on impeachment and what to expect from the inquiry in the coming days. And then we're going to check in on the race for endorsements in the Democratic primary, where Joe Biden has picked up some steam recently. Lastly, what happened to Kamala Harris's campaign? We mentioned before the holiday that Harris doesn't have a lot to be thankful for, and the media has covered this plenty, so we will elaborate on what we meant and what the media is keying in on as far as her campaign goes. Here with me to tackle all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
Going well. Thanks, Galen.
Good to hear. Also with us, senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Fabulous. And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good. It is weird to see everybody dressed up.
Yeah, we're all dressed up
today. I think I'm kind of wearing normal clothes.
Claire.
I am. I said you guys all looked very cute in the suits.
If you're
everyone's wearing sport coats.
Yeah, if you're watching and you're confused, this will not be the new normal on the podcast. We just have some other obligations today that require...
And if you are curious what we do look like, here's a shout out to 538 on YouTube. Go check us out. The lovely Tony Chow, who's with us in studio, keeps that up and running.
Yeah, Tony.
Well done, Tony. Next podcast I'm going to rock. Today actually is the final day to get the 538 swag at the store. And I got some cool hoodies ordered from the store, which I'll...
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. Represent. It's 538.com/store. There is also, I believe, for the next day through Tuesday, that code 538 podcast is also still up and running if you want 10% off.
So. Makes a great stocking stuffer, people.
One of my nephews asked me for...
I get requests all the time.
Yeah.
538.com/store.
I don't think he knows who we are, by the way. Just like that.
Either way, whether people know what we are or not, great, great stocking stuffer. That's what I'm going to get you, Claire.
Thank you.
I'm going to get you a 538
That's
t-shirt.
So sweet. All right, let's begin with impeachment. And we're going to keep this somewhat brief because we'll be covering the hearing later this week. And we're also going to get the results from our panel poll with Ipsos later this week as well. But before the break, we noted that there was a dip in support for impeachment, but that we were waiting for new high quality polls to come out. And that was a dip in our tracker. Now our tracker shows support for impeachment and removal back up near its all time high of 48%, with 44% opposed. So, Nate, do we have a better sense now of what caused that dip? Was it a change in public opinion or something specific to the polls that were in the field at that time?
No, we don't really know. Because we kind of have these gaps where, like, for some reason, there were, like, no super high-quality telephone polls conducted for a period of about 2 weeks. You also had a thing where pollsters were switching from asking, do you like the impeachment process, to focusing almost entirely on should Trump be impeached? So I don't know. I mean, there are two stories you can tell, both of which are plausible. One of which is that you see Adam Schiff in Congress debating all this stuff that momentarily causes support for impeachment to go down. And then Sondland, some of the evidence comes out and that shifts it back up. The other story is that, hey, it's been fairly high the whole time, but hasn't really moved all that much. And I tend to favor the latter story a bit more. It's kind of the Occam's razor story that, you know, people kind of flipped out over a few polls of mixed quality. And now that you have more polling last week, then it kind of is right back where we started.
Claire, does this seem like we're in an equilibrium now? Obviously, we're entering a new phase of the impeachment inquiry. Does it seem like the next stage will be any different from what we've already seen in terms of how the public reacts?
Well, I don't know. I mean, because I think last week, you know, I was on the side of, yeah, it kind of makes sense to me that this drop in support makes sense. You know, maybe the Republican argument was persuasive and now we have new information and it seems like it wasn't as persuasive as we thought. I think, though, that we've seen the kind of television primetime case, right? What happens this week will be a lot more dry. The Democrats have said that Wednesday's judiciary hearing will be more legalistic, you know, kind of this solemn process sort of thing. And I think we've already had the kind of compelling narrative storytelling. And so barring something really big, which is completely plausible, you know, I think that people probably have maybe locked in a little bit to an opinion, but I mean, I don't know. Like, I just say that based on the fact that the narrative storytelling part of impeachment has sort of was done on TV.
Yeah. And just to elaborate on what comes next, as you mentioned, Wednesday, the hearing moves to the Judiciary Committee, where they investigate whether or not this was a violation of the Constitution. Also, the Intelligence Committee is going to release a report, and then we've heard that there could be a vote on articles of impeachment by mid-December. So, Micah, I mean, does any of those kind of three events seem like they would move the needle on this much?
I'm of two minds about this, actually. On the one hand, you know, the fact that nearly half the country supports impeaching Trump is stunning. Impeachment is a drastic step, one that the public for a long time was against. So you kind of look at it and think, okay, well, Democrats have pretty successfully prosecuted their case, right? On the other hand, support for impeachment still lags by a few points Trump's disapproval rating. Well, let me clarify that actually. Support for the impeachment process matches Trump's approval rating almost exactly. According to our tracker, 52.4% supported the impeachment process, 53.5%, according to our approval tracker, disapprove of the president. But if you look at only polls asking if Trump should be impeached or impeached and removed, support is at 47.7%. So in that sense, you could argue, well,
there's still potential people that could be convinced that are not happy with the job that the president is doing.
That's the more optimistic spin for Democrats. The more pessimistic spin would be that there are a few people who are like, I don't like the president, right? But don't focus on impeachment. We're voting in a year anyway. Right. It's not like a huge number of people, but like it may be a group of swing voters that feel that way. Although the president's overall approval rating has not really changed. It may have gone down by a point or two since the kind of start of the Ukraine scandal.
Yeah, and looked at that way, then it's like, well, Democrats basically managed to convince everybody who disapproved of Trump that he should be impeached. Looked at that way, then it's like, well, how much did they really accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, wrapping up here, how many people are undecided? Claire mentioned that opinions are pretty baked in. Obviously, looking at the numbers that we've cited, there are some undecided people, right, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, it's about 47-44, which means that there are, doing math, 8 or 9% of people are undecided.
Is that surprising? Is that a small segment of the country after everything that has been aired out in the media over the past
three months? I don't think it's crazy to think that some people would feel ambivalently. I mean, impeachment is a serious step, right? It's only been done a few times before in our history. And so, you know, so people might have ambivalence about that. And I don't think it's some, you know, I think we give too much blame to Americans who are undecided.
Do we blame them?
Nate clearly does. No, but actually, on that note, I do think, you know, going back to, will any of the next couple events in the impeachment process, will they change public opinion? Again, my first guess is probably not. But we do know from the polling we've done with Ipsos that the most persuadable voters on impeachment are also the voters paying the least attention to it. So in that sense, maybe when the House actually holds that vote to impeach Trump, maybe that does move the needle because a big event like that reaches those kind
everybody.
Of more tuned out people. Yeah.
All right. Well, as I mentioned, we are going to check back in on the hearings and our panel poll with Ipsos later this week. So we'll have more for you then. Let's move on to the race for endorsements. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. You'll find licensed physicians and FDA-approved products that help treat hair loss. There's no snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. 4hims connects you with real doctors online, which could save you hours, and it's completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that's shipped directly to your door. Try Hims today by starting out with a free online visit. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. Prescription products are subject to doctor approval and require an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost you hundreds if you went in person to the doctor's office or pharmacy. Remember, that's 4hims.com/538.
It's been a while since we checked in on our Democratic primary endorsement tracker, and that's in part because many Democratic leaders have been holding out on endorsing candidates. Recently, though, Joe Biden's lead in endorsements has ticked up a bit. A key part of the reason that we track endorsements is because candidates with a clear lead have a good track record of winning the nomination. Endorsements both work to signify who the party apparatus wants to nominate and then may also have some effect on public opinion. And that's part of what we call the party decides theory. So the question we want to ask here is the party deciding on Joe Biden? Is there enough evidence, given that he's been ticking up, that the party prefers him? Nate, do you want to weigh in? What do you think? Is the party deciding on Joe Biden?
Thanks for asking a reductive question, Galen. It doesn't let us tackle all the nuances in this problem.
Break it all down. Give me the nuance.
Galen's job is basically for you to say mean things back to him after asking.
You know, I was up till 4 a.m. working on the model. I just want the listeners to know that.
Nate's working on the model.
The banter quality a little bit lower today than
Nate's getting average.
I think you're doing great. You're punchy.
Yeah, like, getting good. Chippier as the model.
Chippier.
It's like a model.
When we record model talks, I'm always totally exhausted and like extremely sarcastic.
It was, what did you say? Your personal brand is a hissing noise? That was the cold open to last week's podcast.
Technically, Claire said that.
So, I think there are a few different camps of people.
Let me guess. Is it 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B?
I think there are three camps, right?
Okay.
And there's an absence of a fourth camp, which I'll talk about, right? Camp number one is people who actually think that Joe Biden is pretty fine. He has 152 endorsement points. That's an arbitrary number, right? It's not actually that large a share of the total number of available endorsements, but he did get by far the most endorsements of any candidate in November. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'm good at counting today. So 7 endorsements as well. Some we don't count, like Tom Vilsack in Iowa, former governor there. It doesn't fit into our category, but it's a nice endorsement to pick up in Iowa. So Biden has led endorsements throughout, but November was actually his best month for endorsements since his campaign launch this spring. I think camp number two is people who are kind of hoping, maybe against hope, that one of the other traditional nominees catches on. So Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, even Julian Castro got a couple of endorsements this month. These are people who would kind of fit the traditional credentials for a nominee in the sense of, we talked about it before, right? Kind of the Goldilocks thing. Not too young, not too old, not too moderate, not too liberal, and they are all pretty well qualified. And so all those candidates are overperforming in endorsements relative to their often, frankly, fairly feeble share in the polls. And the third camp is people who don't know what the hell they're doing, are sitting on the sidelines. That's probably the largest camp still. You've seen a little bit of uptick in activity. You know, Warren rolled out an endorsement in Illinois before her rally there this weekend, for example. Obviously, Bernie, with three of the four members of the so-called squad endorsing him. Those were important tactical endorsements. But there are a lot of people who, I think maybe not to the same extent as these kind of anonymous donors who are quoted a lot, but there are definitely some people who are like, we don't like anyone in the field, or we're going to bide our time, or we don't think that it's helpful anyway to endorse.
So to add some context there, Claire, what do party elites think of Biden? I mean, probably not a monolithic opinion, but basically you've done a lot of reporting on how the party is viewing Biden.
Yeah, I think Joe Biden is seen as being... Well, that's probably how they feel. Yeah, no, I think a lot of people see Joe Biden as a smart guy, a man of a different generation, a person who perhaps doesn't have much of a connection at all with younger voters. But then again, younger voters don't vote that much. He's not seen as being a super great candidate, but he is seen as being the most effective. This is a generalization of party elites. He is probably seen as one of the most effective general election candidates in the sense of winning back Obama Trump voters. I should also note that there was some interesting reporting that came out last week from Politico magazine and Ryan Lizza that was basically about like Obama's post-presidency. And, you know, Obama's reported opinion on Joe Biden's campaign is somewhat measured, which I have sort of gleaned as well from that world a little bit, which is to say Obama has a very good personal relationship with Biden, but is quite circumspect about his abilities as a campaigner. And I think, but the one thing I will say is Biden's campaign has been, and I think we'll talk about this a little bit more in the last segment about Kamala Harris and what went wrong with her campaign. Biden has had a decently resilient campaign for all of the weaknesses that he has as a candidate and as an individual. And I think that that's something that is the party elites see. And whether that's because he has tons and tons of relationships in the party, whether it's because he has, you know, he's well liked by black voters and older voters and voters without a college education, generally. I don't know. He's sort of the field. He seems to people to be the safest choice. And I think that there is a small C conservatism among politicians about rocking the boat, about how to win elections. And I think you're kind of seeing that coalesce right now.
Yeah. What's your sense in terms of whether the party is deciding on Biden?
I think the answer is pretty clearly no. One, I think the evidence of that is how big the field was. In 2016, for example, where the party very clearly decided on Hillary Clinton, part of the evidence for that was the field was clear, right? She only got really one or two, depending on how you count, serious challengers. The other evidence is endorsements have picked up a little bit, and Biden has gotten a few of them, but the vast, vast, vast majority of potential endorsers, the people we're tracking, which is a pretty big universe of people, haven't endorsed anybody yet. Now, I think the optimistic interpretation of all that for Biden is that it's not really a poor reflection on his status as the front runner. It's just a product of the fact that Biden's strongest support is with groups, as Claire mentioned, black voters, non-college educated voters who aren't as well represented in Democratic elite circles. I think that's the optimistic case for Biden. The less optimistic case is what we see in all these reports on like elite donors and stuff, which is that they don't think he's a very strong candidate.
One way to look at this is that Biden has 152 endorsement points, and these are weighted based on if Obama endorses, he's worth a lot of points. If some random DNC member does, they're worth less, right?
Wait, can we take a step back just very briefly and say who exactly we're tracking here when we mention these points and how many people that really
are? We're tracking everyone. Galen, governor, senators, representatives, state representative. No, we're tracking
We're actually not, and we get emails from campaigns about it.
We're tracking governors, senators, representatives, mayors of big cities, state, Senate, and House majority and minority leaders, DNC members, statewide office holders like attorneys general. I like that use of attorneys general not attorney generals.
You really know your way around the English language.
Former presidents, former candidates this year. Andrew Yang, if he were to eventually drop out, he would actually be worth 5 endorsement points. Party leaders, meaning like, Nancy Pelosi and people like that are worth a lot. So it's kind of, people are like, I want more state legislative members and mayors of small towns in New Hampshire. We can't track anyone, but there are a lot of people that we track, almost 1,000.
And so you said 152 endorsement points is how many Biden has out of how many total that you could get?
Out of 2,382.
Okay.
So that's about 6.5% of the possible number of endorsements. So I'm going to kind of tell you how our model would look at this, right?
First of all,
it's that 6.5% number that it thinks is relevant, right? It's not the fact that Biden has whatever, a much higher share. Let me look this up. In fact, Biden might have 30% of the endorsements that have been made so far, right? But it's the 6% of all possible endorsements that will make the model say, okay, actually, you'd rather have 6% than 1%.
Wait, what do you mean? If total, only so he has only 6% of all total possible endorsements.
When there are a lot of endorsers sitting on the sidelines, then there is more chaos.
Right.
Right. So, and it's more the absolute number of endorsements that seems to matter and not the relative amount. That's one like fairly clear lesson of the Donald Trump primary, right? On the one hand, you could say, okay, well, Marco Rubio has more endorsements than anyone else or Jeb Bush. On the other hand, there were many, many endorsers who had not endorsed at all. And so when you have few endorsements, it predicts more chaos.
For context, around this point, to the best of your recollection, what percentage of endorsements did Clinton have in the primary right now in 2016?
Hillary Clinton. She probably had half of all possible endorsements,
right,
or something,
so it's
at this
quite,
point, right?
Quite different.
And Clinton is actually a data point. I mean, in weird ways, the Clinton-Bernie race is in some ways more problematic from like a party decide standpoint. Let me explain why.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly, Clinton won that margin, that primary, by a fairly wide margin in 2016 in the end. Bernie won a lot of states. Clinton won the big states, won more votes, more delegates, et cetera, right? She did not put the contest away in a way that you might have thought early on when she had this giant lead in national polls, and instead you had a prolonged contest where Bernie performed very kind of vigorously, right? And so from like the model standpoint, the model would say, okay, that's a case where the party really did unite around one candidate and they did not improve from point A to point B. Therefore, this is evidence against endorsements mattering. Whereas in the Trump case, it would say, okay, here is evidence for my kind of somewhat revised thesis that like when you don't see a consensus of endorsements, then it doesn't mean very much except that actually, if anything, there's more uncertainty and more chaos.
Do you think we can chalk the chaos or the withholding of endorsements this time around to the fact that there was a lot of, even if she won the 2016 primary kind of on a walkaway, that there was bad blood, for lack of a better word, and that a lot of people are a little bit afraid of saying, oops, I endorsed Joe Biden because I thought, okay, he has the best chance of winning, but Pete Buttigieg or Elizabeth Warren won the first two states and then they had momentum. Like, are so people afraid of...
I'll give you one thing I think is not proven, but it's kind of ironic if it is true, which is that I think the AOC and Omar endorsements kind of touched off around, because it's the pace has picked up since then, where people are like, okay, hey, we're doing the endorsement thing after all, right? That was a kind of very classic, though, in a sense, use of like saying, hey, look, we are trying to draw signal that like Bernie is a candidate who you want to get behind, right? And maybe younger Latino urban constituents, which is someone any candidate could stand to do better with, right? But I feel like since that endorsement happened, that the candidates were like, okay, actually, if even Bernie is using endorsements as a way to win news cycles, which he clearly was, then the cat's out of the bag a little bit, and no one's going to say, okay, everyone's lining up behind one candidate or another. And so I think you're seeing actually like kind of more honest preferences.
Although, I mean, to Claire's point, relative to past primaries, still many of the party players are on the sidelines, and the Democratic endorsement primary looks more like the GOP side in 2016 than it does the Democratic side. So what is like the rationale? What's the theory for why party players have not weighed in to a larger extent so far?
I think it's a couple things. First of all, I do think it's a reflection on how strong is the front runner, how strong the front runner is even before they enter the race officially, and how strong they're perceived to be. Research shows that has an effect on how big the field is, right? And so once you have a big field like Republicans had in 2016 and like this time around, then you have this issue where I know lanes can be overdone at points, but to use the lane theory of the primary for a second, you have multiple viable candidates in each lane, right? So if you're a super progressive member of Congress who really cares about economic inequality, and you also care that your constituents see you supporting, you know, torchbearers of that cause, do you support Bernie or Warren? Which one do you endorse? Well, it's not really clear yet, right? Or if you're, you know, from a more moderate district, let's say, and you want to support someone who's more electable, someone who, again, your constituents are going to be happy you're supporting, well, you could go with Biden. You could go with Buttigieg. At earlier points in the race, you could have even gone with Booker or whoever, right? Harris. So, like, there's this kind of paradox of choice going on, I think, where you can't.
That knowing.
Did I use that incorrectly?
No, I'm just trying to signal I'm still listening.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. That's always good.
It's my Michael Barbaro.
But you know what I mean? Like, it's like, You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like there's one type of ketchup and one type of mustard and one type of relish. And if you're a ketchup person, you're like, okay, that's my ketchup.
I feel like relish gets underrated. Relish is a good condiment.
If relish were a Democratic candidate in 2020, who would it be?
Booker.
Interesting.
Unheralded, you know, the unheralded condiment that everyone secretly likes.
It's establishment, and yet, where is it on your dog?
All right. So
that's a good take.
Keying in a little bit on Biden's position, we've mentioned that he's leading in the endorsement points. He has 152. Closest behind him is Harris with 95, then Warren with 65, Booker with 59. Sanders with 48, Klobuchar with 47, and we go down the line. What are either roadblocks or an optimistic case for Biden's position right now, given both endorsements and where he stands in polls, Claire?
I mean, if he doesn't do well in Iowa, it's not the death knell by any means of his campaign, but a lot of senators are staying on the sidelines. There aren't going to be a lot of people for any of these candidates who are sticking their necks out. I mean, I think like AOC and Ilhan Omar are sort of the exceptions on in many ways to the elected official rule because people are playing it safe. So I think guessing we'll see more endorsements as the first primaries get closer and closer for sure. But I think Biden has to, I think he needs to nudge up his poll numbers a bit
in Iowa.
Yeah. He's not doing great. So I think that's kind of, if I were one of these people that we're tracking, that's kind of what I'd be keeping my eye on, right? Is like, and I guess he's just launched a bus tour across Iowa called, what is it? The No Malarkey Tour?
No Malarkey.
So Biden is, as they would say, barnstorming Iowa currently.
The optimistic case for Biden, I think, is that there's nothing that kind of stands in his way, is one way to put it, right? It's significant that Warren, during her prolonged search in the polls, because there was talk about, okay, maybe Warren is more acceptable than Bernie to the party establishment, or she can build bridges. You know, she did not gain very many endorsements during that period. The Kamala Harris's, we'll talk about her later, right? She was someone who almost caught Biden in endorsements at one point, and she has had her own problems, right? So, I mean, what I kind of interpret this to mean is that if any of Warren, Sanders, or Buttigieg perform well in Iowa and New Hampshire, that the party's going to be quite interested potentially in, can someone who is not one of these three, probably Biden, come back in Nevada, South Carolina, Super Tuesday and hold that door open, I think, right? I mean, because the other three, I mean, Biden's very old and that's the problem for him. The other three are not exactly traditional candidates. I mean, clearly, Buttigieg is not traditionally well-credentialed, sorry, Pete Vans, for the nomination, right? Doesn't mean you can't have him picked. Trump wasn't well-credentialed, right? Or Jimmy Carter was kind of a governor, but like an outsider, right? Can happen. Bernie would clearly be a factional candidate, kind of runs against the party establishment. They'd be unusual nominees. Warren's a bit closer. And in some ways, like kind of the most important event of the primary so far, I think, is that period from mid-September to now, or mid-October to now, where Warren gained all this traction in the polls and then began to have issues. But like, you know, I don't think that an Iowa loss would be as devastating to Biden, given the other three frontrunners right now, as it might be in different circumstances, and endorsements are part of that. Wait. By the way, I do think if Biden were to perform well in Iowa,
you might see a bunch of people bandwagon.
Then I think it gets tricky for the other candidates.
Wait, okay, here's the question, though. How much does who wins Iowa indicate to the party establishment who is viable and who they should get on board with? I mean, for example, in 2008, Hillary Clinton had a clear lead in endorsements going into Iowa, but then she lost Iowa and then tables turned significantly to Obama eventually leading in polls and in endorsements. So does Iowa have the ability to not make people kind of coalesce around Biden per se, but just pick a different frontrunner altogether?
I think if you had Harris win Iowa somehow, or Klobuchar or Booker or Julian Castro,
it depends.
Right? But like, I am not sure. I mean, I'm pretty sure that you will never at any point have a consensus of party elites behind Bernie. That seems like the safest thing.
Well,
I'm somewhat sure that you're going to see a lot of resistance to Buttigieg. I'm slightly less sure that you'd see a lot of resistance to Warren. I mean, still, if I were Biden, Warren surge 2.0 is still after like a club of surge or a Harris comeback are the things that or Booker bounce but, would be the things that would worry me.
But that's actually so I would actually reverse. What are the chances that, let's say, Buttigieg wins Iowa, that the party coalesces behind them? Not totally, but in some meaningful way. I think that's actually maybe more of an open question than if Warren wins Iowa. Like in some ways, the fact that Warren did have this prolonged climb in the polls and never really received a meaningful increase in endorsements is super telling. And I think maybe should make us reevaluate how, like, I think all of us went into this campaign thinking, oh, Warren is meaningfully more acceptable to the party establishment than Sanders, but maybe it's not. Maybe she's not meaningfully more acceptable. The fact that Harris had a much more momentary blip in the polls and yet got way more endorsements out of that than Warren says something.
Yes, I agree. I think in some ways, Warren's popularity has grown, worry from party establishment people about her has grown with it because of the healthcare plan. But I should also point out, okay, there have been and remain a ton of candidates in this race, as there were in the 2016 Republican primary. How many endorsement points did Trump get? Like 40-something?
Well, like none until after Iowa.
Right.
We weren't tracking this wide a universe of endorsers.
So, like, I just feel like we should bring that up, right? Of, like, who knows? Like,
yeah, like, it's...
Oh, you can win without...
Right.
Somebody could win without the party ever coalescing behind them.
Right. We should... I think we all know that, but, like, just for listeners, we're not saying that you need...
Right.
We're not saying that the party decides necessarily holds up here.
I mean, loosely speaking, I think, again, to go, because we're actually... delete that swear word... I'm programming the model kind of as we speak, right? I think the model would actually say that the endorsement data is largely good for candidates outside of the top four because it means that a lot of powder is being kept dry. It means that if you were to have potential for a late surge, that there could be excitement about that. So it's not like it's good news for Buttigieg or something that Biden does lead in endorsements, doesn't have that many, right? It's like kind of bad news for all the front runners and suggests that, like, we are in some ways still at a relatively early stage of the process.
Well, I don't know. I could argue it's good news for Sanders and Warren because if they're unacceptable to the party establishment in some ways, then the more the establishment keeps their powder dry, is disorganized, doesn't coalesce behind somebody, that leaves the door open for them in the same way it did for Trump, right?
Yeah. We're going to move on, but I just one quick question. When exactly can listeners expect that we will publish the 538 Democratic primary polling average?
I think it'll be I think it'll be next week or the week after, somewhere in that range.
All right.
Is that the average is coming before the model?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what you asked for, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, listeners, a little insight into our editorial process.
All right. For our final segment today, we're going to talk about the state of Kamala Harris's campaign. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. What actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power, claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes. Well, if you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses ensuring an even clean. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. Good habits matter to live a healthier life, so help form fresh oral habits with Quip. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/538. This is a simple way to support our show and start brushing better, but you have to go to getquip.com/538. That's getquip, QUIP.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538 to learn more. Recently, the state of Kamala Harris's campaign has been the subject of plenty of media scrutiny, a seemingly promising campaign that reached a high after the first Democratic primary debate is now polling in the low single digits alongside Andrew Yang. So we want to take the time.
Why are you picking on Yang?
Well, because they're the closest. She's at 3-point-something and he's at 3-point-something in the polls.
Nate's gone full Yang gang on
us. Yeah, I don't know. Why are you being so defensive?
Oh, God. Put in his place, Nate Yang Gang.
All right. So we want to discuss what some of the hypotheses may be for why Harris has cratered in the polls after a high of 15 that put her in the range of Sanders and Warren. And I don't think that we can necessarily come to one conclusive answer here because campaigns are complex. But Claire, kick us off here. What are some ideas for maybe why Harris's campaign has gone south?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I am thinking back to a piece that I wrote about Kamala Harris back in May. And it was largely, you know, I went to New Hampshire, I saw her, talked to some people who had known her in her early politics. And it was largely a piece about the notion of electability and identity and how Harris sort of reacts to the questions of whether a black woman can win the nomination. And the one thing that did strike me among, you know, talking to people who had worked really, really closely with her was people said she's very private. She's very, you know, she's sort of, she's all in on the work. She's, you know, but she's a person who's hard to get to know personally. And I keep thinking back to that as I read all these reports about the problems with her campaign, because a lot of the problems seem to boil down to there was a lack of a cohesive narrative from the top about what kind of campaign it was, right? So Harris has taken a lot of criticism for her campaign, you know, using a lot of poll tested lines and various ones throughout the primary. Was she going to lean into her record as a prosecutor? Was she going to apologize for it? What was the central thesis of her campaign going to be? Was it going to be I'm a truth teller, or was it going to be I'm going to prosecute Trump? And there's a lot of talk in the reporting around her campaign that her sister Maya, who is her campaign chair, and her campaign manager, who is not her sister, there's been a lot of tension and ideas between what the two of those two people think Harris's campaign should be, what the strategy should be. Initially, I think Harris's team frankly thought she would be doing better with black voters. We can go into the reasons why perhaps there's, you know, maybe some hesitation among black voters to support Harris, but there was originally a South Carolina focused strategy. Now it's a little more Iowa focused. We got to prove to people we can win. So her campaign has suffered perhaps strategically, but I think it's undeniable that Harris has been in the national public eye since 2016. You know, she's a black woman senator. She has drawn for like nigh on a decade comparisons to Barack Obama. And she is a forceful public speaker. She has, you know, she certainly has like a charisma on television. So I think there's lots of reasons for people to have thought and, you know, that she was going to be a star. She was going to remain a top tier candidate. But also, interestingly, I think some personal and strategic reasons why her campaign is having trouble.
So a question about the strategy of South Carolina specifically, and part of the reason we're focusing in on this topic is because of reporting from the New York Times and Politico. And here's a quote from the Times article over the weekend. Quote, a strong showing in South Carolina, which votes fourth, would vault her into racially diverse Super Tuesday states like California that would propel her candidacy. So for much of the year, she focused on competing against Joe Biden in South Carolina and beyond. What her campaign did not anticipate was that Mr. Biden would remain strong with black voters and that Senator Elizabeth Warren and Mayor Pete Buttigieg would rise as threats in Iowa and New Hampshire. So was focusing on South Carolina, the fourth state to vote, always a bad idea? Or is this just something you had to try and then find out whether or not it was working? What do we make of that strategy specifically?
It could have worked had they seen it through. Okay, so one hypothesis for what went wrong with the Harris campaign is that it was like mismanaged, right? And the New York Times and Politico have reporting to that effect, basically. And this, I think, is evidence of that. My question would be, if your strategy is to focus on South Carolina, why would you then be surprised that other candidates would rise as a threat in Iowa and New Hampshire? Did you think they were just going to not campaign there
or
something?
Like, it's like they're like, oh, if not for the five or six major developments of the campaign, we'd have gotten everything right.
You know? Exactly. So maybe if they hadn't then seen that and changed course to focus on Iowa, maybe if they had been like, screw that. It's kind of what the Biden campaign is doing, right? Screw that. We're focused here and we're going to keep working there. Maybe it would have worked. But look, there are like a bunch of plausible explanations for why Harris has struggled. Okay, one, Biden is strong, right? Black voters really like Biden. Nobody has been able to really eat into his lead among black voters. That explains a lot of this. Two, electability has been an overriding concern in this campaign. Harris is a black woman running in a country that just elected Trump.
Although running for the nomination of a party that just nominated a woman and before that a black candidate.
Yes, but I think it's different this time.
Yeah, running for a party that just nominated the first female major party nominee who just lost to Trump.
Right.
And so a party that is in many ways kind of like shell-shocked and worried about nominating a candidate who is not a white male, maybe more worried than they need to be.
I think black voters are, we talk a lot this year about how Democratic voters are super strategic, all this stuff. I think black voters have been very strategic. Like, let's go back to 2008 as our example, right? Black voters did not initially support Obama in South Carolina. You know, a lot of people I talked to in South Carolina for a story I did in Joe Biden brought up Obama and Harris as comparisons. And they said, Obama wasn't doing well in South Carolina until he proved to black voters that he could win white people in Iowa, right? And, you know, Jim Clyburn said to me kind of essentially, maybe that should be Kamala Harris's strategy, right? Which is to say, prove to black people that you can win white people. Prove that you are electable, right? And that's and that is something that maybe that she's obviously, I think her campaign has bought into because she's kind of going whole hog on Iowa, pun not intended, but whatever.
And also a consequence of the weird primary system that we have that
totally
elevates places
and
like
I,
Iowa.
And right. I do think, I mean, to go back to, there's tons and tons of talk among the Democratic Party of like, Iowa and New Hampshire are not at all representative of the Democratic Party or of the demographics of the country. So let's focus on South Carolina, Nevada, California, wherever Harris is obviously from and where there's tons of delegates. Now Harris is kind of like people are going after her California delegates, right? Like, you know, Buttigieg has his eyes on California. You know, their original strategy of like, we're just going to win, you know, the big post-Iowa, New Hampshire states. That's where we're really going to pick up a lot of votes. Well, now you got competition for that stuff too, potentially, right?
How much do campaigns matter? Like, do we have a general sense historically in a primary of how much is the person's ability to win up to their own personal talents, their profile, the state of national politics versus the actual campaign structure that's behind them?
Well, let's separate those two and take them one at a time. So one, the Obama comparison, I do think throws into sharp relief the question of how much does candidate performance matter here? Harris is an immensely talented politician. Obama was a once-in-a-generation talented politician. And so Harris has that really great first debate, climbs in the polls, and then kind of gets hit for a number of reasons, kind of waffling on health care. Her next couple debate performances, I think, weren't as well-reviewed. How much does that explain this? I don't really know, but I think does point to the fact that it took Obama being, you know, crazily talented as opposed to just super talented. So that's one point of difference. How much that matters versus like the reported messiness and disorganization and inability to like settle on a strategy of the campaign, I think that's tougher to say.
I also think just to push back a little bit, Micah, on the Obama stuff. Yes, I'm not trying to say that Barack Obama's not an extremely talented politician.
Hot take.
But also, there are also a couple key differences between Obama and Harris. The first thing that comes to mind with me is Obama was a relative moderate, right? And that was that was kind of on purpose, right? He has always been extremely upfront about his political pragmatism. He's been really, really quiet during the primary. When did he choose to speak out more vocally, not to endorse a candidate or to publicly push back on Trump around impeachment? He talked about sort of the outrage culture on the left and how he thought that that was damaging. It's really interesting, actually, right? Like, he is a person who's always put his I'm a moderate compromising guy first. Harris, like many others in the Democratic Party, not to single her out, but she certainly has painted herself as more liberal, more progressive. Now, you can make the argument that she's waffled back and forth on that throughout the campaign, but there you have it. And two, Obama's a man and Harris is a woman, just to throw it in there, that also exists, right? The idea of a woman versus a black woman versus a black man, that stuff plays in. But I do think that the moderate thing versus the progressive thing is also a very key difference in winning a party primary like this.
So there are two excuses campaigns sometimes have that we might kind of latch onto if we were trying to be sympathetic for a campaign that is failing or is perceived to fail or after it failed, right? One of which would be that a campaign never really kind of got traction to begin with. It's always a little bit hard to do that. It definitely can be in a 26-candidate race, hard to like actually monopolize attention. Harris was treated, including by this news outlet, 538, as a front runner, got plenty of media coverage. Maybe it wasn't always positive, but like she was taken quite seriously. Secondly, like how much second guessing is there? Are the critiques that you're making things that were criticized in real time, or are they post facto rationalizations? With Harris, I think actually a lot of this stuff was criticized in real time. Her kind of pullback in the second debate was very strange. Her issuing a healthcare plan in between the two debates that she wasn't really kind of prepared to defend was very strange, right? Pushing too far to the left when you had Bernie and Warren in the field was something at least this outlet was a little bit thought might not be the best strategy, right? Kind of saying, oh, I'm moving to Iowa is a very weird strategy. I don't know. So it is like, you know, there's been a lack of commitment to any type of strategy. And like, I don't know. I think this is actually kind of the case where indecisiveness, mismanagement actually maybe is the right story. Although also like, look, if you go back and look at a list, I look at a list of kind of that Chris Saliza and Harry Enten put together in December.
Who?
Former 538 colleague and still friend.
You shall not be named.
Harry, who is happy with the snow right now, Enten, particular list. And like in general, on that list, the white male candidates, with Beto O'Rourke accepted, have tended to perform well relative to expectations. And anyone who's a minority or a woman has not performed that well relative to expectations. So, you know, that's worth pointing out also.
We had this like historically diverse field, and now that we're really down to a top tier of four, three of whom are white men. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, of that four, of course. Sanders,
the future
Biden,
of the Democratic
Buttigieg.
Party is dot 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 white guys? Men. Question mark.
Yeah,
Claire's referring to an article that she wrote way back
in 2017. Yeah.
But to flip,
sorry
this,
to say, I called it.
To flip this question momentarily, I mean, I think Claire, you mentioned this in last week's podcast that at the beginning of this primary race, a lot of people took Warren's campaign for dead, basically.
Yeah.
Is her steady rise in the poll a result of a well-run campaign? Like, kind of if we flip it's, this question around a little bit?
I think the difference between Warren and Harris's campaign is Warren's been around for a decade in national politics, and she's always had a very specific brand.
Mm-hmm.
And her campaign has built on that brand.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that that's a strength. You know, they did come back from the Native American controversy, right? Although if she wins the nomination, that'll certainly haunt her in the general against Trump. But I think I think Warren has a very well-run campaign, actually. Yes, I think, you know, the selfie line thing, whatever you think of it, a waste of time, a shtick, it's certainly viral retail politics, right? And it's a thing that people know her campaign by. Harris, I think, suffers in some ways because she's certainly not new to politics, but she is only 3 years into her national political reputation, her national, you know, her foray into national politics. And her natural brand, being a prosecutor, is something that has gone out of vogue, for, you know, among some circles in the last couple of years. Now, she seems to be leaning back into it. I'm prosecuting the case against Trump. I think there's an argument that you could make that, like, moderate white Democratic voters maybe would be into the prosecutor thing. But it's a little understandable why she was backing away from the way that she built her career, because there's a lot of talk now about criminal justice and, you know, looking back on the past couple of decades of how American Democratic politicians included prosecuted drug crimes and how sentencing was done and who the people were at the front lines of that was inevitably prosecutors. So it's I think it's tough for her. She's also in a very, I think, difficult situation.
Has Warren run a good campaign considering how much of a mess she's in on healthcare?
Well, that's certainly like a big misstep. But I think overall, building a brand, she's built a solid brand among Democratic voters.
I mean, all that internet stuff, like running and waving and the selfie lines, as you mentioned.
A year ago, if you had told me that Elizabeth Warren would be one of the top three candidates in the Democratic primary, I would have been like, I don't know about that.
But,
so I think
but
it's
hold on, though, because a year and a half ago, because we did these stupid drafts and whatever, right? She was consistently someone who was regarded as a front runner. a very formidable candidate, and then had a period in December, like exactly a year ago, you're right, exactly a year ago was Pocahontas and was this kind of very kind of false start for Warren, right? But like, but you know, I mean, she's had, I think, you know, it's like the sports analogy.
Oh, bring it.
It's like if you're evaluating the tenure of Sam Presti with the Oklahoma City Thunder as general manager, it's kind of like the James Harden trade, right? Healthcare is like trading away James Harden. I mean, you can overcome it. They almost won a championship without it, right?
But can like, we do like a reality TV analogy to kind of combat that?
Didn't Chloe date James Harden? Excuse me while I Google this.
Okay. Our worlds are coming together.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, we're debating Harris' campaign and not Warren's. Like this healthcare thing.
She did.
Okay, there you go.
All right, now I can relate to what you just said.
This healthcare thing is a colossal problem for Warren that may cost the nomination.
All right, we'll save that for another podcast, another day. But can we wrap up on Harris here? Did you have a closing thought?
Well, what I was going to say is actually, I think the Warren trajectory is actually, and Nate made this point on our Thanksgiving podcast, which I thought was a good point. The Warren trajectory should caution us all against writing the Harris campaign off permanently, as Nate pointed out, without a dominant front runner emerging so far. You could still imagine scenarios where Harris gets herself back into this thing.
If I were advising her, I'd be like, Iowa, talk about how many white people there are. I mean, a little bit more subtle than this, right? But like,
that hasn't worked for Julian Castro.
But Castro doesn't have a pulse in the polls, and she sort of kind of does. Like being at like 4% or 5%, believe it or not, is a lot better than being at 1%.
But here's another case where I think you have to talk about the candidate's race and gender, where Harris is limited in how liberal she can seem, because we know from research that voters already are more likely to view women and non-white candidates as more liberal than they actually are, right? And so Harris has always been kind of in this tricky place where does she play up the prosecutor record and risk alienating black voters or super liberal voters, or does she move to the left and then, you know, kind of exacerbate perceptions that might already exist?
She also so oftentimes these candidates who are kind of running not in the center like as moderates, but like to bridge the party together, right? They're also making like a pragmatic general election case. She has some of the worst numbers against President Trump, actually, in head-to-head polls. I think in part because if you're like a woman or a person of color, then kind of, I mean, there's research on this, we were just talking about this, like then you are perceived as being more left-wing than you might be based on your policy positions. By the way, it's important with Warren as well, right? I think Warren thought, hey, look, I am kind of cleverly signaling to different sides here, right? Yeah, we're going to have a wealth tax, but I'm a capitalist, so-called, right? Yeah, we're going to have a Medicare for All bill, but we're also going to have a plan for public option, right? I think it's like kind of harder when you're a woman. People kind of see the more left-wing policy positions there.
To wrap up, Nate's point about Harris being a coalitional candidate and kind of billing herself as, I think fairly as, hey, I'm someone who can keep all the different camps in the Democratic Party happy, including the Democratic establishment. That's reason to think that these stories about the kind of mess in her campaign would hurt her more than a candidate like Bernie Sanders or someone like that, because the people who do pay attention to those stories are Democratic Party elites. And if you're billing yourself as a coalitional candidate, you need those elites, right?
I have no closing argument.
I win.
All right. Well, I think we're going to leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Good show.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And again, you've got about a day left to head over to the 538.com/store to get 10% off using the code 538podcast. Again, 538.com/store. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Actually, tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.